I thought about condensing a handout just to a front and back, but
knowing that we probably won't cover everything quite as in depth tonight, wanted y'all to have something you could take home and use in the future. So first thing that we'll do, the front of that first page, is we'll look at two icons of evolution that have been disproven but are still taught as fact. Every biology textbook, and I mean almost quite literally every biology textbook that's current, still uses these two examples, the Miller-Urey experiments and Haeckel's embryos. This book by Dr. Jonathan Wells, he covers about 12 of these. 12 of these. It's in this book. Again, y'all are more than welcome to borrow these if this is something that you're interested in. But who has heard of the Miller-Urey experiments? So this is the experiment. Stanley Miller, I believe, was a PhD student, and Harold Urey was his advisor. And they wanted to simulate the Earth's primitive atmosphere. So what they wanted to do is say, well, they operated, of course, from a Darwinian perspective, and they said, well, we're going to try and simulate what the atmosphere would have been like whenever life started, and see if we can get life started in a lab-like environment. And so what they did is they assumed, well, we think that atmosphere would have had a lot of methane, a lot of ammonia, hydrogen, and water. And so they put all of those things, and you've got a little picture there, actually, of what their tests look like. So they put all these gases inside this closed system, and then they ran sparks. They brought electricity into the factor, into the experiment, to try and see if shocking it, simulating lightning, could somehow get life going. And so these experiments resulted in the spawning of amino acids, which was just, you know, everyone was amazed. And so within years, it was in textbooks for high school, for college, for post-grad, and everything in between. And it's still in textbooks today. The problem is we know that the atmosphere that they simulated is nothing like what the atmosphere would have been like. It's very, very convenient. They said it would have had a lot of methane, a lot of ammonia, a lot of hydrogen, and a lot of water. If you know anything about oxygen, oxygen is oxidizing. That's where we get the word oxidizing from. It's very, very good for us to breathe, but it's not good if you're trying to get life started, because it breaks things apart. It doesn't pull things together. And so, of course, they look at the four things that they chose: methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water. These are all something, they're called reducing elements. So in other words, they would make the spawning of life much easier. And they essentially assumed there's no oxygen in the atmosphere before life gets started. They made this massive assumption, but what they did was they said, well, if we want life to get started, we can't have oxygen, and so we're going to assume there was no oxygen. And so they drew their conclusion based on their assumption, and that's the logical fallacy called begging the question. You can't do that. In 1995, John Cohen said the early atmosphere looked nothing like the Miller-Urey simulation. We know that there was oxygen in the atmosphere. Of course, we know that biogenesis didn't take place. But even then, they're able to look inside the rock samples, and they're able to tell that oxygen has always been in our atmosphere. And so there's no reason, there's no evidence for us to believe that the atmosphere was ever full of methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water. So the entire foundation of this experiment was proven to be inaccurate. The thing that bugs us, though, and that's absolutely amazing, is this experiment is still found in science textbooks. It's in every single biology textbook. The fact that they got amino acids from running the simulation, that's awesome, but it's dishonest. It's not science anymore, because all you're doing is you're presenting this information. We got amino acids in the lab. Number one, amino acids are very far from biogenesis. It's very far from complex life, number one. But number two, you're drawing these conclusions and you're not telling the readers that simulation was absolutely nothing what the atmosphere would have been like. I'm talking too fast again. I have another quote here, the number two under letter C. Well, actually, we'll look at number one. They underestimated oxygen amounts because it is an often fatal to organic synthesis. It's a detriment. And so because of that, they assumed that there was no oxygen. But once you remove the methane and ammonia, the variety of organic compounds produced in these experiments decreased considerably. So what they did is people have gone through and they've redone these experiments in recent years, but they removed the methane and they removed the ammonia, and all of a sudden you stop getting these complex amino acids. Which is absolutely amazing, because if you stop getting the amino acids, then it's not possible for them to even use this experiment as evidence for biogenesis. So it's dishonest on their part, and it's again, it's still found in these textbooks. So, upsetting, but something that we can use to buffet our faith, or to bolster our faith. Probably not buffet. I think buffet is the opposite of the word that I'm looking for. So the Miller-Urey experiments. Number two is Haeckel's embryos. This is another one that bothers me. So whenever Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, he wrote it, but he didn't really have any scientific training. He was trained in theology. He wasn't a scientist. And so he didn't have any of these images or these drawings. Ernest Haeckel, he drew these pictures of embryos. You've probably all seen these before, whether in science textbooks or just, you know, I mean, this picture is everywhere, you know, of Haeckel's embryos. And it's, again, this is still found in biology textbooks today, and people have known for centuries that Haeckel made these pictures up. These aren't what the embryos look like. He made them up to fit Darwin's theory. So in other words, he read The Origin of Species, and the quote here says, "Biologists have known for over a century that Haeckel faked his drawings. Vertebrate embryos never look as similar as he made them out to be. Furthermore, the stage Haeckel labeled the first is actually midway through development. The similarities he exaggerated are preceded by striking differences in earlier stages of development." And again, in the appendix of this book, he goes through 15, I believe it's 15 to 20 college-level biology books, and every single one of them contains the Miller-Urey experiment, and every single one of them has a picture of Haeckel's embryos. It's still taught as science, it's still taught as evidence for evolution, and yet people have known for centuries that Haeckel made these images up. They're not even remotely what the embryos look like. So it boils my blood. Because it's not science anymore. It's dogma. It's dogma is all that it is. Yes, it's a hoax. Absolutely. It's intentionally deceptive on the part of the publishers. Because, of course, they all know that this has been debunked. And yet it's still touted as evidence for their theory.
You can also, like, look at the drawings. It's almost like they're abbreviated forms of the process of an embryo. I can't imagine it being that quick before it goes from stage one to stage two to stage three. Like, it looks phony.
Yeah.
So if you just looked at it, like, if you honestly took time to go through it, and you try to imagine, okay, that first one is supposed to be like the beginning of the embryo, you know, cycle, or however you want to call it. It's just, it doesn't even look like it makes sense.
Yeah.
Just staring at it perspective.
Very true.
Now, Stephen, just to remind me of, what is the point he's trying to make with this picture? He's trying to make that all look the same at the beginning?
Yeah, so the embryos all look the same, and then they kind of diverge, they fall into their respective elements, their respective species. And so you see you've got a picture of a baby, a picture of a pig, a goat, of a fish, of a bird, of a reptile. It looks like a little baby turtle there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's essentially saying all the embryos look alike, and then they kind of fall into their respective species. But again, this isn't what they look like. And even then, he only chose vertebrates. And he only chose five of the, I believe, I forget how many excluded he excluded some of the vertebrates from his drawings that didn't match his theory. And so he cut out some of the evidence, and then even the evidence that was kind of similar, he made it look more similar than it actually was.
Yeah.
So again, like you said, this is a hoax, it's deceptive, but these are still found in textbooks. So
I'm gonna tell you, can I make an observation from
yeah, please.
Historical perspective. I like to read a lot of our American history, and a lot of the Old West history, the American Indian, the outlaw clashes. But the amount of embellishing written during this era, the 19th century, I take, for example, Pat Garrett, who did kill Billy the Kid. Well, Pat Garrett wanted to capitalize on that experience because Billy the Kid was such a popular being, he saw it as an opportunity to make money. So he embellished his own story and he fabricated it, but wrote it as fact, wrote it as truth. I find it interesting that, historically speaking, many people embellish and lie for the sake of profit.
Yeah.
I don't know if science is like that altogether, but it seems pretty parallel to me.
It strikes me that
embellishing things.
Mm-hmm. Like the science world relies heavily on politics. It feels, it smells like politics to me.
Yeah.
Because if you say, I'm a young earth scientist, or I'm someone who believes contrary to, say, these two items that are commonly published, or I don't necessarily see this as logically sound, scientifically sound, that you're, like, ostracized without it ever being, you know, questioned, like, okay, let's talk about it, kind of a discussion.
And that's a perfect segue into what I have. I have, it's entitled A Statement on Cosmology. This was actually published in New Scientist, which is a science magazine, in 2004. This wasn't that long ago. Listen to the first paragraph or two of this. It says, the Big Bang dominates ideas about the history of the universe, but its dominance rests more on funding decisions than on the scientific method, according to Eric Lerner and dozens of other scientists. The Big Bang today relies on a number of hypothetical entities, things that we have never observed, such as inflation, dark matter, and dark energy. Without them, there will be a fatal contradiction between the observations made by astronomers and the predictions of the Big Bang theory. In no other field of physics would this continual recourse to new hypothetical objects be accepted as a way of bridging the gap between theory and observation. It would at the least raise serious questions about the validity of the underlying theory. Now listen to one more paragraph. And this is going to back to what Catherine said. Today, virtually all financial and experimental resources in cosmology are devoted to Big Bang studies. Funding comes from only a few sources, and all the peer review committees that control them are dominated by supporters of the Big Bang. As a result, the dominance of the Big Bang within the field has become self-sustaining, irrespective of the scientific validity of the theory. In other words, the scientists that have the pocketbooks, they'll write the checks to the younger scientists, they're all supporters of the Big Bang theory. So in other words, if you want funding to do your research, you better believe what we do, or else you're not getting any money. And what this article argues is, essentially, what you have is a closed loop. Because if you want to do your research, you better believe in our theory. You better have our perspective. And so that just propagates the theory and the dogma. So, again, I've got that up here if you'd like to look at it. It's called The Statement on Cosmology. And about 15 to 20 different scientists signed this in agreement. Which is encouraging, but this one I think is the clincher. Has anyone ever seen this? A Scientific Descent from Darwinism? Let me read you the statement. We are skeptical of claims for the ability of random mutation and natural selection to account for the complexity of life. Careful examination of the evidence for Darwinian theory should be encouraged. And what this document is 25 pages of PhD scientists who have signed this and said, we don't think Darwinian evolution is the way to go. We have serious doubts about its complexity. And it's 25 pages of scientists who have signed this and said, you know, we're not confident that this is the way to go. So this is a super encouraging document. It's one sentence long, but just the fact that there are that many out there, you don't hear about these people. You know, whenever you hear of scientists and atheists just kind of goes hand in hand. No questions are asked. If you're a scientist, you don't believe in God. But and this document is still being added to. Whenever I first printed this, it was 23 pages long. Now it's 25. So the list grows. Did you have something, Miss Evelyn?
Yeah, I was just going to make an observation.
Evelyn. No,
Evelyn. Let me tell you something. Evelyn, I have a few things to say to you, and you can take it up with her in just a moment.
Yes, sir.
Very quickly, you mentioned the money circle, the loop. Now, I don't care. I'm not here to get in discussion about climate change, what people believe, what they don't believe about it. But that is the exact same thing that we're having there. Is if you want grants, if you want money for your studies, you have to believe that climate change is man-made, that everything's being done by us.
Yeah.
And the same thing was true with that. That's an interesting thing. If you're going to support Darwinism or this type of thing, you can get money.
Yeah.
If you're going to rebel against it and say, I don't believe that, guess what? You're not going to get any funding. And we see that circular thing. And I'm going to turn it over to my assistant, Edwin, now.
Yes, ma'am.
I was thinking of the simplicity of the Bible's explanation for many of the things that science can prove and has proven, yet there's this push to go to the opposite direction of what is established biblically, simply because they do not want to believe in something smarter than they are. And there was an atheist that made a statement that believed in evolutionists that said that no one ever thought of the brilliance of Darwin's theory of why does a garden or a landscaped garden have to have a gardener. And he called that brilliant theory because they want to be smarter than God. And in doing so, they make absolutely no sense whatsoever, no common sense whatsoever.
Good point. And in regard to the climate change, I think the evidence does show that climate change is taking place, that temperatures are climbing. We've been taking temperatures since the 1800s, and they are climbing. The sticking point is, number one, the alarmism. The whole idea that we're going to have to move to Mars, and that's foolishness. I think the temperatures are changing, but like you said, you have to take the extreme approach and say, well, humans are causing it, and we're the problem. I'm hesitant to say this because I don't know the exact numbers, but from what I understand, volcanoes put out more greenhouse gas per year than humans do in every other source. Volcanoes are the primary source of greenhouse gases. So I don't know too much on that, so I'll leave that alone.
And this is my personal view, is
okay.
We are cyclical. I think that
exactly.
Through heat, yeah, and cooling, and we even have that within our own, well, within our recent history with the little ice age.
Yeah.
And what preceded that was an extreme warming period that even places like Scotland, that far north, could actually grow certain citrus before the little ice age came along and took care of that for them. They couldn't grow that type of thing anymore.
Yeah, and if you even look at the data, based on I believe the field is called like paleogeology or something, by looking at the rocks, you're able to tell different things about past climates. And they'll even tell you this is one of the coldest periods in Earth's history. This is not, you know... This is not something to be alarmed about in the least, because, and I'm sure some of you will remember, what was it, 25 to 30 years ago, they were talking about global freezing?
Global cooling.
Yeah, they were, you know, talking about how everything's going to ice over and we're not going to be able to live here, so it's silly. And we know based on Genesis that seasons will continue until the Lord returns. So that's the promise, and we can take peace in that, so... Any other comments on the icons of evolution, numbers 1 and 2? Okay. Now we'll look into some challenges to Darwinian evolution. I have four of these. That's all I assumed we'd have time for. And we may not even have time for all of these. We'll just kind of play it by ear. But you have pretty much everything that I have there with you, so you can go home and look it over if you like. I wrote a paper for my philosophy course on irreducible complexity. And the first point there, letter A, is a quote from Charles Darwin in The Origin of Species. Listen to what he says. And one thing I will say very quickly is that science is falsifiable. And so if I have a theory that I have the theory of gravity. And so the theory states that, you know, if I have this book in my hand and I drop it, then it should fall to the floor. But if it doesn't fall to the floor, then my theory is wrong. That's falsifiability. And Darwin actually included this in his theory. Listen to this. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, then those three are very important, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find out no such case. And so he says, this is the way out. If you can find an example of this, then my theory couldn't take place. Because, again, Darwinian evolution is an all-or-nothing proposition. Based on his theory, life all came from a single cell. Single cell, it started replicating and replicating until eventually you had your fish, and then you had your amphibians, your reptiles, your mammals, your birds, your people, and you know, the list goes on. So what you can essentially say is, if anything doesn't fall within that nest, that bush, if you will, then it falls apart. Irreducible complexity, and this is the basis of this book, Darwin's Black Box. He is a Michael Behe, or Behe, I'm really not sure. But he is a biochemist, I believe, who was an atheist, and through his work in biochemistry, he came to believe in God. I believe he's a deist. He's not even a theist, but he still believes in something based on his work, I believe. He came up with something entitled Irreducible Complexity. And it simply says that it sounds big and scary, but all it means is it's a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. So in other words, it sounds really big and scary, but all it means is you've got something and every piece is required for that thing to work. There are no extra pieces. There's nothing that makes it look good. It's pure functionality. And if you have something like that, then it can't evolve, because if you take one piece away and put it in later for it to evolve, then it doesn't work in the meantime. And if it doesn't work in the meantime, then it's not going to be selected by natural selection. It's not going to be passed on to the next generation. Because hypothetically, good traits are only passed on to future generations. So you take one piece away, it stops working, it doesn't pass on. And that's exactly the picture that you have there, is of a bacterial flagellum. Bacteria, of course, they have to move around, they have to get the food, they have to get the fluids that they need. And the only way that they can move is through these filaments, these flagellum. And this is an example of an irreducibly complex system. Each piece that you see here of that flagellum is vital for functionality, and it couldn't have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications. You take one piece away, it doesn't work. Therefore, it can't happen slowly. You can't get the bacterial flagellum, the flagellar motor. It can't happen all at once because it's too complex. But at the same time, it can happen a little bit at a time through successive slight modifications, because you need all of it for it to be passed on. And so that's the idea behind irreducible complexity. He has like 5 to 10 examples of that in this book. It's probably the driest thing I've ever read in my life. But it's very encouraging. Because all he's doing is he's just going through and systematically saying, you know, point after point, this system wouldn't work. This system wouldn't work. This is just one example of dozens in the human body that essentially say, listen, this system couldn't have evolved. It's too complex to happen all at once, and you can't have it a little bit at a time because each piece is required for it to function. Yes, ma'am.
So is there any studies that show the cessation of the whole Darwin theory, or do they believe that it is continuing to take place, that in a span of time that apes will eventually become humans again? I mean, is this something that is perpetually still evolving?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Evolution continues. You know, evolution is still moving on. I haven't heard them, you know, postulate what's going to come next down the pike. But wouldn't they
have some type of research to say that it had to have ceased because if time is continuing and all you need is certain elements of matter in an environment over a span of time, then there's got to be something that is existing that would have evolved in a billion years because it's been here a billion years.
Yeah.
In other words, we would have been able to see something evolve if it's occurring the way that they're saying it occurs. But because we haven't seen anything evolve, they haven't been able to duplicate it scientifically, they have to conclude that in some way it is not happening the way in which they say it's happening anymore.
Yeah, and that's why they argue for the long periods of time. That's why they say, well, it is happening. It's happening all around you. We just can't see it because we're inside of time. It's so slow. It takes place over X number of generations, and so you can't see it while it's happening. You can just look backward and see it in the past.
That's what Brother Dan Cake, Curtis Gates used to say. He said, if you give me enough time long enough, I'll be able to jump the Grand Canyon. Just give me enough time. You know, in a million years, I'll be able to jump it all, you know, little by little. You know what I'm saying? If you give it your way, all you want is just give it enough time and it will evolve.
Yeah.
That's the thing I thought of.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah, but irreducible complexity, they can't explain it. And one of the arguments that I look at in my paper is, one of their arguments is, well, all the pieces for the flagellar motor, they were in another system. They were actually in a virus. And then that virus changed into a bacteria and whatever. But what, I forget, I don't believe it's this book. I believe it's another book. And what this guy essentially says is, well, that's nice, but you've only got like 3 or 4 of the pieces that you need from that virus, and you've got like 15 to 20 in the system. So yeah, you've got some similarity, but you can't bring all of them. And so it just doesn't work. So the irreducible complexity, it's complex. So as it says in the title. So it's super interesting though, and you know, how do you get around it? Because even Darwin said, if you can show me a single system that can't be generated by successive slight modifications over time, my theory, it couldn't work. It just couldn't work. I believe an irreducibly complex system is an example of something that would falsify his theory.
Well, could you also think in terms of, you know, Darwin's talking about how, you know, it took these fish and stuff, you know, millions and hundreds of million years to change their fins into little feet and legs, and their lungs are developed. But that they missed out on things about how do they survive in the process. And I saw something, and this was many years ago on the National Geographic show. And they were talking about this particular breed of penguins down on the southern tip of South America. They're called rockhopper penguins. And they come up out of the water and they jump onto the rocks. And they're unique. They have little actual claws in their feet so they can grab a hold of the rocks and they can get over on the land. But they said it took them, you know, literally millions upon millions of years to be able to jump up onto these rocks and hold on. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not the smartest person in the world, but how'd they get out of the water before those flippers or whatever they have for feet, webbed feet, turned into claws? How'd they ever get it? What kept them from drowning? Well, that's similar to this idea here. Every piece has to be there or it can't function.
Yeah.
Dead. Yeah, and
it was dead before it came alive.
I know.
And what they're forced to argue is a good example of what evolutionists are essentially forced to argue is
say you have a scooter. Your young son has a scooter. He has a scooter, and that scooter has to turn into a bicycle. That's essentially what evolution is. But here's the catch. You have to change that scooter to a bicycle, but each step from scooter to bicycle has to be a small step, and each step has to be better than the last. So each thing you do to that scooter to turn it into a bicycle has to be better. It has to be beneficial, because if it's not beneficial, it won't be passed on to the next generation. And so what they're forced to argue is each step from scooter to bicycle. And we know conceptually you can't improve on any one of those in transition, and it doesn't work. But that's what they're forced to argue, because in order for it to be passed on to the next generation, it has to be better than the generation before it, or else it would fall out of the gene pool. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're forced to argue, and it doesn't make sense. Yes, ma'am.
Is that survival of the fittest? Does that come into play there?
I believe so. And it's not, survival of the fittest isn't necessarily the biggest and the strongest. It's the organism that's able to adapt. It's the organism that's able to survive in whatever environment it finds itself in. I think that would come into play as well. I believe that's the idea of natural selection.
Now, when we're talking about improving the scooter, can I say that it's like a small mutation that is going on in the scooter?
Mutations. Yeah, that's their,
it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in objects. How can it come make sense in living creatures?
No.
And we know that mutations are not good for us anyways. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we find here on number two.
Thank you. You did that on purpose.
Well, I'm just brainstorming. Yeah. Remember things. Yeah.
So, any closing comments on irreducible complexity? Again, that one's over my head. I don't think I explained it very well, but it's so powerful. Just the reasoning behind that example. And again, I have all these books that y'all are welcome to borrow if you'd like to look into it. So, number two, genetic entropy. So the primary axiom of evolution says that man is merely the product of random mutations plus natural selection. But based on what Raphael just said is, the human mutation rate is extremely high. It turns out that we have about 3 mutations every cell division in our body, which is just astounding. So in other words, let's say the human genome is a computer program. It's a block of code. And it's millions and millions of lines of code. A mutation is going in and changing a letter in that code, in the millions and millions of lines. What are the chances that changing a letter in a program is going to make it better? What are the chances? Almost zero. Almost zero. Very, very rarely can you find examples of positive mutations. But again, that's something else that the evolution is forced to argue, is that these mutations just... they help the organisms. They're great. I mutated and all of a sudden I have wings and I can fly. It doesn't work that way. Mutations are so very rarely positive, so very rarely passed on. The vast majority of them are neutral. The vast majority of them, again, each generation's of people, and this is us, each generation passes on hundreds of more mutations to the next generation. And so each successive generation has more and more mutations in their genome. And the argument based on this is, at the rate at which mutations are accruing in our bodies, that's why we have cancer. That's why we don't live as long. Here you have a picture there of lifespans after the flood. And notice that. That's called exponential decay. That's whenever you start up really high with Noah, and it's just below a millennium. And then all of a sudden now we're down to essentially 70, 80 years. But that's just with the help of medicine. Darwinian evolution hinges on mutations benefiting populations over time, but the opposite is true. And Sanford, this information I got from this book, Sanford said, in deep geological time, we would have been dead a long time ago. The fact that anything still exists... because of the rate that we're accruing mutations in our genome, it's surprising that anything exists. Another scientist said that we should have been dead 100 times over if the genome is billions of years. Because we would have accrued so many mutations that life would no longer be able to exist, we'd no longer be able to produce offspring. So that's another piece of evidence against long periods of time, is you can't have that
Because if you have that genome existing for such a long period of time, it simply wouldn't be able to handle that many mutations and still be viable for life. It doesn't work. You can't do it. You can't make it happen. So, again, compare the human genome to a computer program. How long will the code remain viable if random changes are made over time? It won't. Ryan probably knows this better than any of us. You have a big block of ones and zeros. You randomly change the ones and zeros one at a time. You're going to to have problems very, very quickly. In fact, in many cases, you change 1-1 or 1-0, and it could stop functioning right there just from one change. So genetic entropy is a problem that, again, they're trying to wrap their minds around, but they can't get around it because of the rate that we're accruing mutations. So, any comments? Sorry, trying to slow down. Getting pumped.
You're doing great.
Okay, awesome. Hoping I'm making sense to someone. Okay, so number three, lack of transitional fossils. And this is actually going back to what we were talking about a little while ago. I have two quotes here, one from Darwin and then one from a current scientist. And this is Darwin speaking. He wrote, "But just in proportion as this process of extermination has acted on an enormous scale, so must the number of intermediate varieties or transitional fossils, like a fish becoming an amphibian becoming a reptile becoming a bird, which have formerly existed, be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Why do we find these pieces everywhere of frogs becoming lizards, of lizards becoming birds? We should find them everywhere, but the fact is that we don't. Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and serious objection which can be urged against the theory." This is another example of Darwin saying, "This, if you could show that this is there, then my theory couldn't be correct. That's falsifiability." But Darwin argued that in the future, they're going to find all these examples of transitional fossils. Look at the next quote. And this is Dr. Colin Patterson. He's a senior paleontologist of the British Museum of Natural History. Someone asked him a question after he wrote a book, and the person asked why his book did not contain pictures of transitional fossils. Listen to what he says. "I fully agree with your comments about the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I will lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil for which one could make a watertight argument." There are no transitional fossils. And the picture there is of their favorite one. I believe it's pronounced Archaeopteryx, something along those lines. Which, again, Icons of Evolution has been proven again and again that it was a bird. It was not a transitionary fossil. That there's actually, I believe, an entire chapter on it in this book. So, the transitional fossils aren't there. They don't exist. We can't find them. That's another challenge that they're trying to address. Number four.
I'm sorry, but that was what I was referring to with the time. Why are we not seeing it all happen? Because if the world has existed for the billion years, something has reached the billion year mark at this point in existence, mm-hmm. and we should be seeing it evolve in front of us because it has existed. So I've often wondered in their research, why have they not at least made an argument to the point of human involvement changing some of the evolution? And that's the reason why we don't see it as much as we do.
Yeah.
They don't even deal with this particular argument, number three, that you're saying, to the obviousness of existence today.
Right.
Because there are no transitional fossils, as you're saying, and we should be seeing them if their theory is correct.
But they're not there.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great. We'll look at number four. The origin of the singularity. And the singularity is what they refer to as that, what they love to refer to in all the textbooks is like the dot the size of a piece of lead from a pencil or an eraser or something along those lines. That was the universe before the Big Bang. That's what exploded, was the singularity, is what they refer to it as. Like we addressed last week, there are only two possibilities. Either matter is eternal, either that speck always existed, the universe has always existed, or that matter came from nothing. That's what they're forced to argue. But what they seem to be able to evade is that both of those break the laws of thermodynamics. spontaneous generation. This is the idea that the singularity just came into existence. It came from nothing. And Stephen Hawking, arguably one of the smartest people to have ever lived, he argued for this so very hard. I have a quote here from Miller, Jeff Miller from Apologetics Press. It's in this book. If the universe as a whole initially contained no mass, matter, or energy, and then all of the mass, matter, and energy in the universe spontaneously generated, the first law would have been violated. That violates the first law of thermodynamics. You can't have no matter, mass, and energy, and then have lots of matter, mass, and energy. That breaks the first law of thermodynamics. And I forget who it is, but they argued that at the time of the Big Bang, the laws of thermodynamics, they weren't working right yet. They weren't functioning. And so, therefore, they only came into play after the Big Bang occurred, which is, you know, so convenient. And it's also interesting, they're forced to argue that gravity worked in the opposite way. So instead of gravity attracting, masses attracting each other, they repelled against each other. And then somehow, you know, things just went back to the way they are now. I don't know how, but neither do they. Yeah.
Can we fathom for just a moment, if everything in the universe was contained in this little thing about the size of a dot of a pencil,
mm-hmm.
what kind of mass that would have required?
Yeah.
That's illogical.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
But what we know, every effect has to have a cause nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
With anything and everything.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden for them to suddenly suppose that there's an effect without a cause, if I'm understanding it at the very basic level possible the right way,
yeah,
it just doesn't make any sense.
It's true. I have another quote here, and this is actually someone that argues very, very firmly for the for spontaneous generation. He says, "I must admit that there are yet no empirical or observational tests that can be used to test the idea of an accidental origin. Test is supposed to be falsifiable. It's supposed to be testable. That's the foundation of science. If you can't test it, then don't argue for it." But he says, this is what I'm arguing for, but as of right now, there are no empirical or observational tests that can be used to prove my theory. So, spontaneous generation, it doesn't work, and almost no one is going to argue that matter is eternal, that this mass has always existed. What they'll actually argue is that you have a dot, you have the point, it explodes in the Big Bang. Eventually, everything condenses back down in the Big Crunch, back down to a singularity, and then it explodes again. And so, essentially, time is just this, you know, this repetition of big bangs, big crunches, and we're in the middle of one of these cycles.
So the Earth is burping? What is this? That makes no sense.
I don't know if they've ever used that analogy, but I guess we could.
Sounds like to me, a bunch of gas just coming out of it.
I see science in conflict with science.
Yeah.
And the internal strife is real. I mean, it's there. It's just like the facade of say liberalism or something. People act sweet on the outside, but internally they're full of hate. Not real happy people.
So the idea of eternal matter contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. And Miller said that if the universe has always existed, it's eternal, but there's a finite amount of usable energy, then all usable energy already should be expended. So in other words, there's a very set amount of energy that we have in our universe. Each time you explode and then draw back, you're using that energy, and that energy is becoming less and less useful as time goes on. So technically, we should have no energy left. So the fact that we exist, almost no one is going to argue that matter is eternal. No one wants to argue this because they can't explain why we still have energy. And then all they're doing is they're just pushing it forward. Well, where did that singularity come from in the first place? So then you're right back to the original point of where it came from. So, and then there's a final quote there that you can read if you like. So, we cover a lot.
Tonight. Why are we so? Yeah, I mean, where's this energy still coming from? I mean, then 2 Peter 3, it talks about there's coming a day when a big old ball of energy is fixing to boom, melting fervent heat. You know what I'm saying? I mean, our life is about faith.
Absolutely. Yeah. And not only is it about faith, but it's also about, it's about being rational. It's about following the evidence where it leads. And
well, faith is rational.
Yeah, exactly. But from the
one is not irrational.
From many people's quote unquote scientific approach, faith is the opposite of rational. It's believing things that you don't have evidence for, but the evidence is actually pointing in the direction of Scripture. So, I hope tonight's been as encouraging for you as it has been for me. I love this stuff. I hope it's been helpful. So we have a reason to believe the things that we do, and it's not because of what our parents taught us. It's not because of it's tradition that's been passed on. It's because it's true. It's what's right. It's what the Bible says, but it's in harmony with reality. So we can have peace in that. Yes, ma'am.
Institute of
SCR, Creation Research.
Mm-hmm. And now is opening really soon.
Oh, yeah?
This month or next month. And it's got a lot of visitors.
Really? Very cool. Very cool. Have to go visit. All right. Thanks, folks.
Thank you.